Hi, friends, and welcome to the By Faith podcast. My name is Christine Hoover, and I'm so glad you're here. This season on By Faith, we're talking about the ins and outs of vocational ministry. As you know, my new book, How to Thrive as a Pastor's Wife, releases next week. Friends, the best pre-order deal is from my publisher, Baker Bookhouse, where you can get the book for 40% off retail plus free shipping. They're also doing a deal until March 1st where you can get my two books, Messy Beautiful Friendship and With All Your Heart, for 40% off at the same time. I put the link for that deal in the show notes, so go grab a copy or two. I want to tell you about two corresponding guides that I've written to go along with How to Thrive as a Pastor's Wife. The first is a personal reflection and discussion guide. So for each section of the book, there are reflection questions for you to work through as an individual. The second set of questions are group discussion questions. You can use these discussion questions with other pastor's wives in your area or your network. So that's the first guide, and the second is a guide for you and your spouse. It's meant to facilitate the process of discussion and connection regarding ministry within your marriage. It's not long because I know you're really busy, but my hope is that it will spark good conversation between the two of you, even beyond what I guide you through, and help you thrive together. Both of these guides are free and can be found on my website, howtothriveasapastorswife.com. Okay, friends, for today's episode, my guest is Carone Loveless. When Carone's husband was the pastor of a large church in Florida, he had an affair with a woman who worked on staff with him. Carone joins me today to tell her story, what she's learned in the years since the affair came to light, and what she would want pastors and pastors' wives to know about being in ministry without losing your soul or imploding your life. So here, friends, is my conversation with Carone Loveless. I'm really privileged to get to talk today to Carone Loveless. Hi, Carone. Welcome.
Hey, Christine.
I'm so glad that you've been willing to join me. I heard you on the Glass House podcast, which I really love, that Lindley and Ben Mandrell are doing. And I knew as soon as I started listening, I wanted to have you on to share more of your story. So thanks for being willing. Can you just start by introducing yourself and what you're doing currently in ministry?
Yeah. So, my name is Carone Loveless. It's a little different pronunciation. So, and I'm married to David, and we have three grown sons and bunches of grandchildren by them.
How many?
Eight. Not
okay.
That many, but eight. Yes.
That's a lot.
And, we have a ministry to pastors and their wives, that is to really help them gain a healthy soul. Like, you know, lead a thriving ministry without losing their soul is usually what we say. And, because we have lost ours in the process of trying to really lead a healthy ministry as we perceived it to be. And, so we, out of our own story, out of our own issues, out of the things that we've learned, we decided that we were not finding enough people that were really kind of doing this kind of work. More and more, we're discovering pockets of people that are, but, at the time we weren't able to find that many. And so we just said, we want to be able to do this. So we want to be able to, you know, serve the church in this way. So, we coach and, meet with, leaders, pastors, their wives, as couples, as individuals, depending on whatever the issues are that they're dealing with. And also, I'm an artist, so I also do some art on the side, and, I'm an Enneagram coach. I'm a certified Enneagram coach. So I spend a lot of time coaching people through Enneagram things. And, also David is a pastor at a First Orlando here in Florida. And, so we have a busy life.
Yeah. It sounds like it. That's a lot of different things. You're a woman of many gifts and trades. It sounds like. What kind of art do you like to do?
I do florals and landscapes and, just a little bit of everything. I like illustration, and I've been an author, so I also like writing. So that's a whole nother piece of my story, but, that's just the direction, you know, God put me in. I'm grateful for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd love to hear as much of your story as we can hear today, and then ask some questions out of that that will help us as listeners to learn from you and what you've walked through. Can you take us back to you've talked about kind of a slow erosion of the soul, I would like to go back to that, even prior to, you know, your husband's moral failure. Where can you describe that time of your life, and what, now you look back and you can see kind of a slow erosion. What do you see now?
Well, we had a very large ministry in Central Florida, and we were so grateful for it. Going way back, when I was about 16, I gave my life to Christ, and I said I wanted to follow him, and I wanted a calling. Felt like I had a calling to serve in the ministry somewhere. I didn't know how, I didn't know where that would, you know, end up, but I ended up marrying a guy who wanted to go into ministry, and I was thrilled. And so both of us were like on fire. We were just set to go, and we couldn't wait. We went to seminary together. And then we planted a church in Canada for 4 years. And then from there, we came down to Florida and planted a church there and revised a church that was already in existence at the time. And, you know, God gave us just a real passion for the ministry, passion for his people, for the church. And it just kept going and growing. And we were so grateful for all that we were learning and all that God was doing in our midst. At the same time, we recognized, as everybody that's listening, that's involved in any kind of church, it's hard work. And sometimes, you know, we put ourselves in positions. Now we see it. At the time we didn't see it, but part of the time what we called stress, ministry stress, was stress we were putting on ourselves. And we didn't see it at the time. We thought this is what's required. We thought this is how it's supposed to go. This is ministry. It's supposed to be stressful and hard, and it's because we're doing important work. And so more and more, we just spent our time trying to figure out ways to make the church better, more efficient, more effective, and to grow what we thought, you know, was the calling of God on our life at this church. And so many great things happened. So much goodness came. David also traveled with the Willow Creek Association all over the world, leading pastors and trying to help them and their situations make ends meet and figure out how things could go. And it was just a really great ride. And we pastored there for 29 years. Mm-hmm. So it was just a beautiful, beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. But in the background, underneath, there were things that were slowly beginning to erode we call it the vulnerability of our marriage. And then of course it became a vulnerability for our church.
And can I stop and just ask you about that? So you mentioned stress that you thought was normal, but you were placing on yourself. I would love to hear specifics about that.
Yes. So one of the things we discovered was that all of us have internal unconscious drivers, and those drivers are shame, fear, and guilt. So shame is always saying, I'm not enough. Guilt is saying, I haven't done enough. And fear is like, I don't have enough. Hmm. So all of us experience all of those, but usually we kind of lean into one. Like for me, it would be, I'm not enough. And so I was always insecure with how I was coming across or how people were perceiving me. And so, and David would be the same. He would say, he's very confident. You know, we're both very confident people. Has nothing to do with confidence. But beneath that, there's a driver that is, I do need approval. I do need to, and if you knew both of us, you would go, I don't really see that, but it was there. And it was causing us to, the approval that we want. We had just a few people that we really wanted to please. It wasn't everyone in the church, though sometimes that can be an issue. But it was certain people that we really admired and we respected, and we wanted their approval. And so we kept working to gain what we thought would be approval from them. Everybody has those people in our grandstands. We'd like to say it's just God, but we do have those people. And so for me, it was, and for David, it was, I'm not enough, even though I'm giving it all I've got, and I haven't done enough. And if you combine those two things in underneath, again, this isn't something you talk about. This isn't something that you even are aware of.
Right.
But if those things are driving you, then you're going to stress yourself out in one way or another, trying to make those things happen. I've got to do enough for God. We would exaggerate. And I do think we have at times, even if I can say this, perverted a scripture that I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I don't believe I think we've taken it to a extreme that God never intended. Like, I think he meant, whenever you're in something difficult, I can get you through that, instead of, you can do anything you want in the name of Jesus. And that's kind of what we do in the church. Uh-huh. We think we can do anything we want, and God's going to give us the energy and the strength to do it. And that's not actually true. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes we forget we're human. We have limitations. I know we do. And my husband often talks about how he had a Superman complex, that, you know, he had what we call an arrogance of capacity, that you can just keep going and going and going, and God's going to give you the strength to do whatever it is you need to do. Now, that's true to a degree, but we're also in a limited human body. And so we didn't see that. We didn't see that happening to us. And so if you add on top of shame, fear, and guilt that's driving us underneath, then you put on top of that external resentments that happen in relationships, that just naturally happen in a marriage. You could say, David would say this, and he's very open about all this. He would say, I had resentments toward Corona. I had resentments toward my elders. I had resentments toward God, that, God, I've been slaving away here for you, doing these things. I'm sacrificing my life every day. Again, he would never vocalize this. These are all private thoughts, but they're in there. And we've all had them, you know, God, mm-hmm. what else can we do? You know, because we still are struggling financially, maybe in the church, or, you know, we're not seeing the results we want from our ministry. And so David kept also thinking that over time, things would get easier. You know, the longer you're at something, you think, I'm going to get good at it, and I have experience, and I know what I'm doing, and it should get easier. Well, that's a fallacy. It's not true. Life is going to be up and down all the time. And it's never going to just be great or easy. We're going to have great moments and great times. But he had this kind of pie in the sky thinking that, you know, things should be getting easier. And when they got harder, it would really discourage him. Hmm. And so we found that we had a vulnerability in our relationship, but when we can only see this after the fact, unfortunately, we can only see it now later, that there were so many vulnerabilities there. We went through, at the time we were going through a financial crisis in our country, which created a financial crisis in our church. We had some personal drama going on in our extended family that was very, it was sad and hard and stressful. And then, you know, we had just normal church life, you know, which is, you know, where at one point we had to let go of like 25 of our staff because of finances in the, you know, in the culture. Wow. And that was extremely painful and difficult. And so stress upon stress upon stress. And then the stress, as I said, that we add on top of that from ourselves, that most of us never count as stress. We're hard on ourselves. We're really, really hard on ourselves. And so that added all up. And then in our situation, there was a female staff person who came to David one day, and she said, and we'd known her for a long time. This isn't somebody that was just, you know, new on the scene, somebody we'd known for a long, long time. And she came to him one day, and she said, can we be better friends? And he was like, I don't really know what you're talking about. We're already friends. I don't think there's anything we need to do different. He came home and he told me about that conversation. And I was like, huh, well, that's very interesting. I had had another check in my spirit about this person some years previous that I did communicate to him. So it wasn't like this was a super secret at first, but there was another time later where she came back to him again and asked the same question. And he didn't come home and talk to me about it, because he thought, you know, what's the harm of a few conversations with somebody that I know really well and that I trust, and somebody that's been around and gets the ministry here? What's the harm in a few conversations?
And that's what she was asking. Can we just talk more about ministry, or
well,
just spending
time obviously
together?
that was part of the excuse. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, because that would be the common thing. So I'm just saying there's so many ways this happens. Like, in other words, all of those stressors can happen, and then you don't have somebody sitting in your office saying, can we be better friends? Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It doesn't happen if there isn't somebody also there kind of opening the door.
Right.
So all of these things could have been going on, and still things would have been fine. Mm-hmm. but there were still things we needed to work on in our relationship and that I needed to see that I wasn't seeing at the time as severely as I needed to see it. And then fortunately, that's how it works. We don't see what we need to see.
Can you explain that? Because I think some people might hear that as saying, you saying it was my fault that this happened.
Oh, goodness, no. And David would never say that. Right. And he never says that. And we, you know, whenever we're talking together, he's always very quick to say, none of this is blaming Karam. But if I was to give you a list, and there were, we really don't even know all the factors, but I bet we could list about 10 or 12 different factors that created vulnerability in our relationship and in our relationship, in him. And can we say, and I would be one of the 12, but I'm an important one of the 12.
Yes.
For instance, if I had been in a good place, and I will just give you a kind of an idea of what was going on, because there probably are some listeners who are like me. I was very involved in the ministry for a number of years. I was also on staff because, again, it was my life. It was our life to a fault, but it was our life and it's what we had committed to. And so I loved my work. I loved doing what I was doing. I was a creative director for our church. So I oversaw all the worship services and all of that that went into the services every week. And then we grew to a place where it was just too hard for me to manage. I love the creative aspects of ministry, but I didn't like the management aspect. And things had to be managed. And so I could see the writing on the wall. We were starting to have, you know, many campuses, and there was just too much for me as a person, the way I'm wired. It just wasn't going to work. But that meant I had to give up my role. And now I had to find a new place in the ministry. And I'm like, I don't know where that's going to be. I don't know where I'm going to be able to find a place that's as fulfilling as what I was doing and fit in, because all the roles were already taken by this time. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time, how should I say this? Feeling displaced.
Yes.
And resentful that I had given and laid down my life for, like, let's just say 20 years. And now I didn't have a place other than to be my husband's wife. And that's not what I felt God had called me to. So I had this justification constantly that God had called me to ministry and I wasn't fulfilling my purpose. So I was constantly at odds with, okay, there's not really a place for me at the level that I'm used to performing. And so it was constantly, David, why can't you help me figure this out? Why can't we get this worked out? And he was doing his best to try to figure out things on the staff level, but also he had staff and elders that he had to please. So I kept feeling like he was taking their side on things and not sticking up for me. Now that wasn't actually true, but that's how I perceived it because nothing changed.
Yeah.
And nothing changes till you change. And I was the one that needed to change, but I wasn't willing because I kept thinking I was sacrificing myself and my calling for his calling in the ministry. Mm-hmm. So there was a wedge between us over this one issue. Everything else was great, but this one issue was sticky and it created resentment. And then he resented me for not giving him more peace at home over this situation. So as you can see now, when you start listing all of the things that could be going on, you know, the constant need to please people, this internal, external need to be perfect, an example of Christ to your congregation, your children, your extended family, pressure to grow a bigger church, you know, a lack of consistent time dedicated to just play and rest, you know, church finances being a certain way, people leaving your church, right? Coming and going and all of that, being overly identified with the success or the failure of the ministry, you know, and then our conflicts over the roles and responsibilities in ministry. That was just a lot to carry. And then, you know, just normal everyday ministry.
I like that you were using the word vulnerable, that your marriage was vulnerable, that he was vulnerable.
Yes.
Because nobody sets out to commit adultery. Nobody sets out to destroy and implode their life. Mm-mm. And I like also that you're talking about these implicit, these things under the surface we don't even know are driving us toward these certain things, making us vulnerable to these kinds of things. We're all capable and vulnerable to things. And so it makes me think that he was driven toward, or I'm just imagining, maybe you could tell us that this woman was probably giving him this approval without any sort of demand.
Yes, that is exactly what it was.
So he was driven toward and vulnerable. I'm not saying you drove him toward, but I'm saying that made him vulnerable to someone who's going to pour on mm-hmm. approval in the area that he most probably desired it, which is work.
Well, church. Well, that and just there was no conflict. There was no stress. There was no tension. I could use the word tension. There wasn't any tension there. So that's when every other area of your life feels tense and stressful or, you know, heavy, as ministry can feel, you find a little island of there's no tension. You're like, I kind of want to go there, right? Don't we all want to go to that place? I do, you know? And so I can see this now. And I said, I want to be that island for him.
Yeah.
And of course I am now, but I didn't understand. I thought, and I want to say this very, as honestly as I know how, this is a guy who there is no way ever this could happen to, ever. It's just never going to happen to him. It's just not.
You thought.
Well, we all think. And that's why I would love for your listeners, I don't want to scare people,
right?
Because that's not my intent. My intent is to say, I bet you think this will never happen to you. Just like all of us who've not had cancer yet. We think that's not going to happen to me. And it's one of those things where you go, this one thing was literally, if you'd have given me 1,000 reasons that there would be any kind of problem in our relationship, that would be not ever even making the list. It would have never made the list. I just know him that well. And I know him so well that this was, I idealized him, which is a whole nother topic for a whole nother day, how we idealize our husbands in ministry. And then we idealize our pastors in general. But that's a whole nother topic. But I just knew that I knew that I knew I didn't have to worry about that. I didn't ever have to worry about the security of our relationship. And that was erroneous. That was unwise. That was whatever word you want to use for it, stupid, you know, because everyone, and as our counselors told us later, everyone has a limit. Everybody has a limit. They can only go and do so much and go so far. Everybody has a limit. And you have to know where that limit is. And now most of us don't yet know. It's like, oh, I see now where my limit was. It was here and here and here. But back to the thing of where my responsibility lies. Once we get past the shock and the initial trauma of this, we've discovered this has happened. Then we begin to unpack it a little at a time. And as a person, like in my case, me, as I am able to look at all the factors, at some point, I want to be willing and open to see what part of the factor I was responsible for. And I want to be able to speak to that, and I want to be able to see it. So I see that I put pressure on him. I see that I also just wasn't aware. I took for granted that our marriage was like galvanized. There was nothing that could ever touch it. That was naive of me. And for me to know that even if all those other stresses were involved, you know, here in our life, that if I'm not the safe island, the safe place in the midst of all of that, that he is going to be vulnerable. And I like to tell people it's like a virus. It's like your body gets run down. And then finally you're susceptible to whatever is in the environment. And that's what happened. Mm. You just get run down. And he was praying every day. It's not like he wasn't. People always come up and ask him, well, were you just not praying enough? Were you not in the Bible? Of course he was. Of course he was. Mm-hmm. But as our counselors would tell us, there's stuff that goes way underneath our decisions mm-hmm. and our will. And that is when we are under so much stress, we have to find comfort. And we find all the different ways to appease that and to figure out how to do that. So yeah. that's don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that we often think an affair is about sex, but it really there's so much more driving us to make decisions that we probably, I would imagine he at one point was like, what in the world have I done? Like, how did I get here? And it's because things are driving us beyond just sexual desire. And I'm wondering, did you, Karone, ever have moments where you thought something was off and you, are you a person who second guesses that kind of thing? Or did you not have that at all? Or you did and you brought things up? Like,
We talked because we had seen, as you have too, many leaders fall.
Yeah.
Close to us and at a distance. We'd had umpteen million conversations about how this happens and what we could do to avoid that happening to us. So we'd had those conversations. We weren't ignorant of that. So even having those conversations, these things can still happen. And again, it's subtle, very subtle. I'm just having a conversation with this person. It's just a talk. I'm just having lunch and a conversation with this person. And they could be very few and far between. In other words, this isn't something that just we're doing every day. This is very, you know, long distance in between, you know, nothing's going on here. This is just a friendship. I just work with this person. And slowly but surely over time, long time, and I do mean long time, took a long time, you know, things just imploded enough and the stress got just enough. And I don't know if that answers your question, but we had talked about it and we did say, these are the things we want to look out for. And we did know stress was a factor. Exhaustion is a factor. We knew that. And, but also I would say, and I don't know if this will be true of all your listeners, but I know for me, I was so involved in the ministry in its success. It mattered to me if we succeeded. It mattered to me if we failed. It mattered to me if people thought well of us or didn't. It mattered too much.
Hmm.
So as a result, even on our days off, when we should be resting and kind of having, you know, church talk is off limits, I would be asking questions. I would be bringing things up to him that I know he hasn't seen or noticed because I'm a noticer, you know, and as pastor's wives, we notice things, right? We see things other people don't see. Mm-hmm. And we are kind of, we have our little antennas up all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I would think, I got a captive audience. Now I can talk to him about such and such, right?
Yeah.
Which again,
not helping back.
Exactly. He needed a break.
I've done the same thing because I'm such a driven person. Sometimes I can drive my husband. Because I want him to, the success feels not just for him, but also for me.
Exactly.
And so I can drive sometimes not realizing kind of the pressure I'm putting on him. And that's something we've talked about in the past few years is he kind of what you're saying, like he needs me to be his wife, not to drive him with work more and more. Yeah. So I'd love to jump to the point where you find out about this and how... And kind of move into a time where we can talk about how you navigated the hurt and the pain, moving toward, obviously you have a restored marriage and moving toward that. So can you take us back to those first days and months and years after you found out? How did you feel about yourself, your marriage? What did you learn about God and his presence with you?
Well, I can take you back to the day. It was, I was asleep and I woke up to the sound of David crying at the foot of the bed. And I'm like, oh my gosh, honey, what's going on? What's the matter? Did somebody die? Did you have a fight with someone? Is there, you know, I was like, I was so upset for him. I'm like, oh my goodness, you're so distraught. He was sobbing, sobbing at the foot of the bed. And he goes, I have something really hard to tell you. And I'm thinking, okay. But what could it possibly be? I mean, we've been through so many hard things in ministry. There's nothing you could say to me that would be so hard. And he goes, no, I mean, really hard. And I said, okay, what? You know, and he told me, and I was like, no, quit kidding me. That's ridiculous. He goes, no, you know, it's true. And so I respond, everybody responds differently to that kind of news. I responded, usually we bypass the pain and we go right to anger. So I went right to anger because that was that's my path. And it wasn't pretty for quite a while. I at that point found out that he had resigned his position of lead pastor of 29 years at our church without having talked to me about it, because the elders had been discussing this with him for the couple of weeks prior to this without my knowledge, because back and forth, they were thinking, well, maybe we can work this out. Maybe, because it wasn't happening at the time. This is something that had happened 4 years previous and it had just begun. It had just come to light. And Dave and somebody was actually blackmailing him with information. I'll tell on you. If you don't do this, I will do this. And David just said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to tell them what happened. So he went and confessed to the elders what had happened. And because it wasn't a current thing, it wasn't happening at the time. So they were trying to debate how to respond to it. And so that's why it took several weeks for them to come to the realization. And for David to finally see, I can see that they're going to need me to resign. So try to picture this. Your husband has told you the very worst thing you could possibly imagine ever being said to you. Then you've lost your church and your ministry. And what I didn't realize at the time was I would also lose all our friends. We would lose all our finances. I would lose my home. And the words are really it's so inadequate at this point to tell you the devastation that was all told, like all of it. You know, normally when people go through these things, you know, they talk with a counselor, they're able to do this in private, but when you're in ministry, lots of other things are extracted from you. And so we didn't have that advantage, of course. And so we lost everything. And I just went underground. I was just devastated. And I didn't go out of the house I didn't go to the grocery store for 6 months. I didn't go to the mailbox until after dark for fear the neighbors would see it, because it was on the front, not the front page, but it was in the paper, our local paper. It became widely known in national magazines. It just became a story. And so I was just so full of shame, as anyone would. And so was David, but he was handling it as well as anyone could, and as I would expect him to, because he's that kind of guy. He was like, I'm telling you everything that happened. And he was as contrite and as heartbroken and as humble as a person could possibly be in that situation. I couldn't have asked for, as bad as it was, I couldn't have asked for anything more from him as far as his forthcoming ability to, you know, just tell us everything. But when you do that, you know, like I'm thinking, well, he wanted to go and say to, he wanted to tell the church goodbye. He wanted to confess this to the church and ask their forgiveness. The leadership did not feel like that was wise. So we were only able to write letters. I wrote a letter. He wrote a letter. We wrote to the congregation, our dear, dear family, our church. We lost our spiritual community. We lost our friends. We lost everything in this action. We set about at that point to figure out what to do. Now, it's very interesting. I didn't tell him this for about 2 weeks, but within about a few hours, I knew, and everyone's different, I might say, everyone's different, but within a couple hours, I knew that I wasn't going to leave him. And I said to myself, and later to him, either everything we've been teaching our church and our people about Jesus and about forgiveness and about grace is true, or it's not. And if it's true, then it has to work, even in this ridiculous, horrible, awful moment of our lives. And I want to cooperate with that as best I can, even though at the time, I could just tell you, there was no way I could see forward. I couldn't see 2 feet in front of me. I had no clue how we were going to get through this, how God was going to do it, or how we were going to make it. Everything was gone. One of our sons was also on staff with us at the church at the time. Eventually he lost his job. So we had to deal with that loss with him. And with our kids, of course, naturally, it was a very difficult time. They very much highly admired their dad. And so this was very difficult. And That's just an understatement. But you know, I just will say that we were able to find some very good counselors. I had a counselor for me, one for David, and one for both of us. And we spent the next year every single week, sometimes a couple times a week, meeting with them and dealing with things. Because someone in my position is going through trauma. He's going through a different kind of trauma. And so you actually need a therapist that knows how to deal with trauma as well as infidelity. And those are two different things. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah,
you can feel
great.
Free to ask me anything else.
I would imagine there was a deep sense of a loss of identity. Mm-hmm. It's like, I thought we had this marriage. I thought my husband was this person. I thought I was going to be a pastor's wife at this particular church. And I was going to get to serve in this particular way. And now all of it is gone. So I'm wondering, how did you navigate all of that time of the disequilibrium of who am I? Who are we?
That's part of the trauma. It is like a train wreck. It's like you're now hit and now you've got amnesia. I don't know who I am. I literally lost, and this is really hard to describe, but I lost the feeling of the emotional connection to our recent past because it was such a great trauma. So it's like, yeah, I was literally like gone. Yes. Everything. You know, I mean, what kind of wife, who am I as a wife?
Yeah.
You know, I knew that I was still a mother, but as a wife, was I replaced? Of course not. And so we have, when these things happen, we go to super extremes. It's like, he was either this man of God that had horribly failed, or this loving husband who had been unfaithful. But what I came to discover was he was both of those things. He wasn't either or. And whenever people fail us, we always want to go to black and white thinking. I had to learn ampersand thinking, which is both and thinking, that yes, he is a pastor who had failed and a husband who had been unfaithful. But he wasn't one or the other. He wasn't this, I wanted to paint him all this one way. And now that he was not this all beautiful, wonderful, idealized person, now he's this evil guy. Mm. He's just all evil. And we don't know how, in our trauma and our reactivity, we don't know how at the time to bring those two together. And that's actually what God sees. When God sees us, he sees this person and this person as one person. He doesn't separate them like we do.
Yeah. I think I would imagine it would be really difficult to even look back at your marriage. You had been married decades by then, mm-hmm. and to go, oh, that was real. Like we had a true marriage and there were good things about it.
Yes. Yes, totally. Yes. And that's, we had many conversations just of that very thing. What did we have? Oh my goodness. If this could happen, what did we have? Mm-hmm. And of course he would do his best to try to assure me, yes, it was real. That wasn't wrong. This was like a, how does he say it? Like a deviation, a temporary deviation from what I knew to be my life and my truth, you know, like a little, like I would call it like a little, not literally, but I mean, we're talking hours at a time. We're not talking days or weeks or anything like that. Just a deviation from life. And so he was able to kind of spin and tell himself, this isn't that, this isn't something that I think it is. This is something else. And that's how people do these things. It's their ability to compartmentalize. And men are very good at this. They can compartmentalize. This is my life with my wife and my children and my church and whatever. And then I have this teeny, teeny, teeny little place over here that maybe every once in a while I go and I do something that I really can't even tell myself I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't even tell themselves.
They can't even
truth.
Tell themselves. And he couldn't because he never called it what it was until I started calling it that. And it just crushed him.
Oh, called it, this is a friendship.
It's a friendship. Just a friendship. That's it.
Even though there was a sexual nature to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was just a
and
friendship.
So when you said this is an affair, you have committed adultery. That was the first time he really wrapped his mind around it.
Yes. Yeah, I know that sounds bizarre. That sounds ridiculous to us.
I honestly can see that. I mean, I think listeners are probably going, wait, what? But I think we can deceive ourselves so much.
Well, that's what happens when we're in sin.
Yes.
We do deceive. Yes.
Yeah.
We're deceiving ourselves. And he would say on a regular basis to me, you know, of course, I was mostly deceiving myself. And then of course, also deceiving you. But
yeah,
you know, yeah, mostly deceiving myself as to what was going on. And that's what happens. Again, I can see it now with hindsight so clearly. Now I can see it and I can talk to you very rationally. At the time, I would have been out of my mind.
Right, you know? Right. You're making it sound like, oh, it's a little deviation, but we know that it was years of working through anger. And
Yes.
So I want to talk about that, the forgiveness, because that is something that you truly have to choose to forgive. Mm-hmm. You're not going to just feel forgiveness. You are going to say, I know the facts and I take those facts and I choose to release my husband of the debt he owes me because he did an injustice to me. He did something. He committed sin against God and against me. So can you help us to wrap our minds around what does forgiveness look like and how have you chosen to do that?
Well, first of all, I think in the Christian life, we have this unspoken rule that says the faster we pronounce forgiveness on someone, the more spiritual we are. And what I've come to see is that actually the greater the offense, the slower the forgiveness needs to come. Because if we forgive too soon, then we bypass the work that we need to do of reflection and the necessary wound tending that has to happen. So I was somehow able to understand that I wasn't going to be quick to speak those words, I forgive you. And I won't say that some part of me was also, you know, holding that back on purpose, like as a punishment. But I will say there was enough goodness in me and righteousness in me to know that I was going to forgive him. I just didn't know when and I didn't know how. And little by little, I learned, like I said, I had to understand the difference of black and white thinking. A forgiveness begins at the end of black and white thinking. I don't think black and white about him in this anymore. I understand all of this is one person. And he can be this good, godly man and still fail. I also had to recognize this whole concept, and we've heard this many times, you know, to err is human and to forgive divine. We cannot forgive as human beings. It's not in us. That's why it's such a divine experience. It is from God. And as you can't make someone forgive someone. It is a divine act. It has to come from God. And I, as I learned to not, to leave off my black and white thinking, I was able to slowly but surely see that yes, he was this man that I thought he was, but he had failed me and he failed our marriage. But that wasn't all he was, a failure. He was so much more than that. And at the same time, I recognized that God is streaming 24/7 forgiveness down to every single person on the face of the earth every day, all day long. That's all he does. He just forgives. He's just forgiving all day, every day. And so I knew that if that's God's heart toward my husband, then somehow I had to get in on that stream. And so I imagined it. I literally visualized it like a river. And I was to get in that river of forgiveness and soak in that river of God's forgiveness for my husband until it became mine. And it did eventually. But as I say this, I say, don't forgive quickly. The greater the offense, the longer it should take. And also, you know, that when you do forgive, it's not the last time. Mm-hmm. Forgiveness is an ongoing act. And so it's not like I've forgiven you. Like it took me about 4 months to utter the words. Our anniversary came up. And as you can imagine, that first anniversary was pretty rough.
Yeah.
But the only gift I gave him was a 3x5 card in an envelope that said, I forgive you. Hmm. That was my gift that year. But it was the first of many, I forgive yous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't describe to you how, I mean, we spent about 2 years without work, pretty much. I mean, we did some counseling and we did counseling for ourselves. And then eventually we took some courses. We read 1,000 books. One of the things we read was a great book called Torn Asunder by Dave Carter, K-R-D-E-R, Dave Carter, Torn Asunder. And we read it out loud to each other, chapter at a time. And we would discuss it, sometimes stopping mid-sentence, sometimes, you know, reading. And we would discuss and process that way. So we processed with counselors. We processed reading out loud in books. We didn't have another job to go to at the time. And you asked me earlier, how did I see God? One of the ways I saw God is just how different people at different times would help provide for us. And it's kind of like when you're, you need some help if you're disabled. We were disabled. We needed financial help. We could, like, one person, who remain nameless, said, well, you just need to go out to Walmart and get a job. I'm like, we can barely breathe. We can't hardly get our heads off the pillow. We can't, go get a job. I mean, it was so callous and uncaring and unsensing. So we had some people, different ones that would help us financially. That's how I saw God. We had friends that literally, when they heard this happen, they dropped everything and flew to us from the other side of the country. Two or three different people came to be with us. So we weren't alone. And then David also had a group that he met with every week of about 5 men that they either met in person or over the phone. And he would tell them what he's doing, what he's learning, how he's processing, what he's understanding about what happened. And they stayed with him for about a year doing that on top of counseling. So it was a lot. We did a lot of work, a lot of really hard work. I probably read 25 books on my own, just trying to understand, process, get a grip on what all the facets of what can happen. And it was, as you can imagine, an interesting time. But we are at the zenith right now. I love to tell people we are better than we've ever been on our best day previous to this. And most people will tell you that if they can manage to get through the horror and the trauma of betrayal, they usually tell you that they are 1,000 times better as a couple. We understand each other so much better. We thought we were really smart. We thought we knew each other really well. We were talkers. We communicated. It wasn't like, oh, I bet she just didn't communicate with him. No, we communicated all the time. It had nothing to do with communication. But we are at such an amazing, great place.
I'm so glad to hear that. I'm wondering about the other woman, because you knew her.
Yes.
Did you ever confront her? And I'm just wondering about the forgiveness process, because you also have to forgive her. So did she acknowledge that she had done wrong?
No, she left the scene, and any attempts by anyone to communicate with her were met with silence. So there was no response from her at all.
Can you talk about that process for you? Because that's an additional wound of someone who.
I have in my own mind, because I had actually, this will sound very interesting. I had confronted her years ago about something that I saw her do that she initiated. And it was toward my husband. And I had confronted her about it. I was very very upset about it. And I was probably not as kind as I could have been in just approaching her about it. And so I knew that she had some designs on him, but it wasn't anything that I could really prove other than something that I had seen. So yes, I knew that. So there was already something there. She always avoided me. There was always something that was a little strange in the relationship. And I just thought, well, that's just her. That's just how she is. Little did I know. But it just ends up that she kind of went underground and was never heard from again. And we, as far as I know, all still live in the same town. And it's very possible I could run into her one day. And I've gone through, many different things, I might say. But I hope that I will respond well if that happens.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, moving on, you just described how y'all are doing so well.
Yeah.
And you have this ministry now to yes. pastors and pastors' wives. So I want to start by just addressing the question that often gets discussed when things like this happens. Some people say that your husband, someone who's had a moral failure, should never be back in ministry. And then some say, no, they can be restored. And so obviously you guys have been restored to ministry. I would just love your thoughts on that.
Yes. God said in Psalm 51, a contrite heart, I will not despise. And I feel, and we feel, and everybody has their right to whatever they perceive as the right course of action. I know the leaders of our church thought they were doing the best they knew how to do with the information that they had. And we certainly felt like we should have resigned or, all of that. But I don't think we still know how to deal with our leaders and failure. And one of the things that David has come to believe is that he was never qualified from the beginning. It's only Christ that qualifies us for anything and for our calling, whether it's a calling to ministry or a calling even after we have failed. There's so many examples of how Jesus responded to his failed disciples. And so we feel like we understand as much as we can humanly understand what his heart is toward restoring people that have fallen and that have failed him. And in our minds, if the person is repentant, if they're willing to go through a process, now, not everybody agrees with what that process should look like. And sometimes that could be a debate, they haven't gone through enough of a process or they haven't. And it's always interesting to me when they say they haven't waited long enough. I'm like, if your counselors are releasing you, and we would highly, highly recommend that everyone go through a good, long process of counseling. But if your counselors are saying you're well enough, you're healthy enough, you've seen the light, you've understood now where the falls took place and how, and you're healed enough to not be a detriment to people, because sometimes in our woundedness we could still be, we're still hurting and we're not as helpful as we'd like to be. But if we could say we've done all those things, then I think we can go back into ministry and we go better than ever as pastors and leaders when we have seen our own failings and we know now our blind spots. Mm-hmm. So many leaders lead without any awareness of their blind spots and they're hurting people left and right, not only their marriages, but just people in general.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to talk about that. Because you work with so many different people from all over the place, you're seeing some themes.
Yes.
What are some warning lights on the dashboard that we need to pay attention to as leaders in the church?
Well, first of all, where's your resentment? How's your resentment doing? Who are you resenting? Where are, if it could be in your marriage, maybe not. It could be just with leaders or people in the church. Look at resentments, unresolved issues. Things like no objective third party support. So often we see leaders, and because we're smart people, we are leading large groups of people. We think we're smart enough to handle our own issues. That was us. We thought we could handle our own issues. We thought we're great at talking and talking things out, talking things through, but we would just come to an impasse. We needed a third party. Yeah. We needed somebody that could be a support to us. And so right now we tell leaders all the time, if you do not have a third party, you don't have a pastor. And we encourage it to be counselors. And we encourage churches to actually help pay for that on at least a monthly basis. Sometimes more often if there's some things going on. Everybody needs a third party. You just kind of have that. Inconsistent boundaries. So often we just see so many leaders that just don't know how to say no. And they think that they're the answer to everybody's problem. And that's your ego. Your ego is just, I'm the person that can fix this, And so we see this time and time and time again. And we see young leaders doing this. And we look at each other when we hear of this happening and we just look at each other and go, it's just a matter of time.
Oh,
just a matter of time. Because you just can't keep doing it. The arrogance of capacity. I'm Superman. Everybody needs me. And we actually believe there's a body of Christ. And we believe that in the body, there's many members, and many members should be serving the body, not just the lead pastor and his family. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always going to be issues beyond your control that are going to be factors that you can't control. And we want to control them, mm-hmm. you know, and then, you know, just this, all the thing about the ego needing to be noticed and need to be known, needing our churches to be noticed and known, and, you know, just wearing exhaustion as a badge of honor in the ministry. Mm-hmm. We do that. We wear exhaustion as a badge. Oh, I'm serving God, and so I'm supposed to be tired, you know? Well, I don't know. There's a reason why rest is so emphasized yeah. in the Bible, and we just seem to ignore those passages, I think.
So I'm listening to you saying these things in the midst of ministry. And I know other listeners are just like, oh gosh, I see these things in me. I see these things in my husband. I'm not saying I do, but I'm saying as a listener, I have seen these things in my husband. We've discussed this.
Yeah.
But what does a wife do if she sees these things in her husband and she's trying to address them and he is just not seeing it and not listening?
Well, we do what we can, right? We say what we can in love and entreat them. And then I think I would say, can you please find another person that's wise, that's been in your shoes, that understands the journey, to sit with and to talk to about your work and how you hold your work? Mm-hmm. Because, and then it unfortunately, sometimes it is going to take burnout. It's going to take a failure. It's going to take something happening. We just can't see what we can't see. And we don't know what we don't know until it happens. Mm-hmm. So I don't love that that's the case. But one of the things we teach people all the time now is that there is order, then disorder, and then reorder. So we start out in order and we think that's what we're doing, but then disorder happens on one form or another in our life. And that's where we wake up. We don't wake up until things go sideways. And then we can reorder. Or like, it's like life, death, and resurrection. You know, we just see often this pattern, and we don't teach that there will be failure, and it doesn't have to be moral, but there will be failure. There will be blind spots. There will be weaknesses. And we don't teach that as a matter of fact. We teach that as, you know, keep that away from me.
Right.
We're not going there. We try to get smart and go to conferences and figure out how to not do all those things, but we're not dealing with the internal drivers of shame, fear, and guilt that are actually causing a lot of our problems. And sometimes we just aren't willing to see it until we get, you know, have something happen to us that causes us to wake up. I wish I could say with something you could say that would be making a difference. But if that were the case, it probably would have already happened. You know, it's got to come usually from someone else, or from a painful situation that wakes us up. And that's just human nature.
So it seems like we have a lot to learn from people like you who are vocally sharing. This is our life, death, and resurrection. This is what God said. What can we learn? I mean, you've taught us a lot already, but you believe that leaders who have fallen have a lot to teach us. And so
they have more to teach us than leaders who haven't, because they know they're capable of weakness. They have so much more to teach us. They have so much more. And if they're humble and contrite, we are remiss not to listen to them and not to learn from them. It's crazy that we don't. I love leaders with limps. I can trust them. Mm-hmm. I trust a leader with a limp because they're honest. They're honest. And so
what is the drum you're beating over and over and over as a person who has walked through this and you're leading with a limp? What do you most want us to know as kind of the closing question?
That we all have a shadow. We all have internal drivers that we are not aware of, leading us all day long. Every single decision, all the things we do all day long are driven by shame, fear, or guilt. I'm not enough. I don't have enough, or I haven't done enough. And we just want leaders to start to be aware of those particular voices that keep saying, I'm not enough. I got to have this. I got to be noticed. I got to do this. I've got to have more. I don't have enough of this. or I have not done enough. Look, the kingdom is wide and I'm just a little teeny little gnat in the kingdom. I have to do more for God. You know, so we want to give people the ability to be more self-aware. Mm-hmm. And I know that word gets thrown around a lot lately. And I think it's now become a buzzword and now it's lost some of its power. But self-awareness is something that is so important. And it's not even, I mean, that's an understatement,
yeah.
Self-awareness. Yeah. And it does take being outside yourself and having somebody, a third party, preferably, talking to you about what they see, because the reason why they call it a blind spot is because you're blind to it.
Right.
You can't see it, yet you have it. You don't even know it's there.
Uh-huh.
And so many of us in leadership are walking around half blind to ourselves.
Yeah.
And we just want to help leaders do that, get better at looking at themselves.
That brings up your ministry. Can you tell us where, I know listeners are going to want to know where to find you and what kind of resources you offer.
Yeah. Well, it's David and Caron, D-A-V-I-D and A-N-D, Caron, C-A-R-O-N.com, davidandcaron.com. And, you know, we just meet with pastors and their wives or pastors individually. Sometimes David will just coach the men that want to be coached personally on their journey as a pastor. And sometimes we'll coach couples together. It just depends. And we have written a book called Nothing to Prove. We'd like pastors to know they do have nothing to prove, but it seems like they're all trying to prove something all the time.
And often so too, the pastor's wives too.
Oh, honey. Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. Yes. And so, so we wrote a book. We do have a podcast called, the Live True Podcast. And so there's a lot of things on the podcast that people can listen to that we talk very openly about, related to ministry. So those are some options.
Well, I'm so thankful y'all are doing all of that. We need people like you. You're right. Mm. We need even more than people who are successful. We need to hear from people who have walked through it, and you have. So thank you so much for being willing to share with me and with my listeners today your story.
Remember to head over to my website, How to Thrive as a Pastor's Wife, to download your free discussion guides to go along with my book, How to Thrive as a Pastor's Wife. I also want you to know that in the next week, I'll be doing several Instagram live interviews, some where I'm chatting with other pastors' wives and some where they'll be interviewing me. I would love for you to join in with us because you'll be able to ask questions of us as we go along. So come find me on Instagram at ChristineHoover98. Friends, thanks so much for listening to By Faith. Join me next week as I talk with Lauren Chandler. Lauren is married to Matt, who is the pastor of the Village Church in Flower Mound, Texas. Lauren and I talk about being a pastor's wife at a large church and how we as pastor's wives can navigate expectations, people pleasing, and learn to find our place within the church. Until then, friends, have a great week and keep walking forward by faith.